Finding love in the internet age is complicated. You never know who you'll end up with or what they're capable of. A surrogate mom uses love as a lure for torture.
Alisa Baker gives new meaning to the term evil stepmother.
A serial wife finds murder more profitable than divorce.
Most of her relationships with men ended in a violent manner.
And an unhappy housewife trades boredom for bullets.
You placed that gun into her hand, and suddenly she became very confident and very strong.
For these deadly women, seeking love and companionship will end in a tangled web of death. It takes a cold heart to neglect a little girl in need.
There's something special about a child with cancer. It really is.
And a heart of stone to torture her.
The fact that she could starve her as well as beat her tells me that she's a sadistic sociopath.
Queensland, Australia, 2008. Adam Baker is a lonely single dad struggling to raise 8-year-old Zara.
Zara suffered through a lot in her short life. She survived bone cancer, but the chemotherapy left her almost deaf and took one of her legs.
Zara still lives life to the fullest.
She was always smiling. She always had a smile on her face. This is a girl who's been battling cancer, who only had one leg. And she still was able to smile. When I look at Zara and I look at her life, I see a child who just wanted to be loved.
I do know that she was a brave girl. I think that's been mentioned by a lot of people. And what they mean by that is that her infirmity, her handicap, didn't slow her down.
What are you doing, Dad?
Talking to a very nice lady in America.
Adam looks for love in cyberspace and falls for an American named Alisa.
Alisa had a sordid criminal past. She had been involved in all kinds of criminal behavior, dealing drugs, forging checks, assault.
Adam thinks he's met his dream girl, but he's being misled.
Alisa was never happy. When she was married to one man, she'd be searching the internet for another one.
But love is blind, especially when you've never met.
Adam was looking for something, and he thought Alisa was the answer. But Adam came with baggage, and her name was Zara.
At first, the idea of living on the other side of the world is exciting for Zara and her dad. They move into Alyssa's home in Hickory, North Carolina.
If you ask Alisa, she'll tell you, oh, she didn't even call me her stepmom. Zara called me her mom. But if you ask friends and other people, you get a different picture.
I told you to go to bed.
But Dad said I could watch it.
Your dad ain't here now, is he? Don't you dare do that.
What we know is that Alisa frequently beat Zara and kept her locked in her room, only letting her eat for 5 minutes a day. That's starvation.
There's one instance where Zara had a black eye. And there's some people who say Alisa gave her that black eye.
Go on! Keep going!
Alisa even uses Zara's disability to make her suffer.
Alisa Baker forced Zara Baker to run up and down a hill without a prosthetic leg on her.
Keep it going! Run! Go on!
It takes a certain type of evil to commit that act.
Alisa tortured Zara because it made her feel good. It's that simple for a sociopath.
By autumn 2010, Zara is completely under Alisa's control.
When the school year started, Alisa Baker and Adam Baker failed to register her in the public school system, nor did they notify the school system that they were going to homeschool her.
Far away from her homeland, Zara is more and more isolated.
Zara Baker began to disappear and began to be invisible.
Hickory, North Carolina, 2010. 10-year-old Zara Baker has moved from Australia after her dad finds a new wife online. Life hasn't been easy. She survived bone cancer and brutal beatings from her new stepmom. Then, on October 9th, Zara goes missing.
My daughter's missing.
Adam and his new lover claim Zara's been kidnapped.
They call up the local sheriff and they report her missing. She's gone. They can't find her.
They produce a ransom note.
Yeah.
Even more bizarre, Adam says it has taken him 2 weeks to notice his daughter is missing because he thinks she's in bed asleep when he gets home from work.
So this tells me something about Alisa, that she's an ultimate manipulator. That she manipulated this guy into believing that his daughter was there.
It became apparent quickly that Adam Baker was either not involved in his daughter's life or was a liar or both.
How could a father not realize his daughter's gone for 2 weeks? Baffles my mind.
Adam is the prime suspect.
The search was heavy and almost around the clock in the areas around where Adam Baker had been employed.
But police find nothing, and Adam isn't acting like a guilty man.
Adam Baker submitted to numerous interviews, both by law enforcement and by the media.
Authorities turn their attention to Alisa. The kidnapping scenario doesn't make any sense. Neither does the revelation Alisa is about to make.
Alisa Baker confessed to authoring the ransom note, the fake ransom note.
Then, Alisa's attorney drops a bombshell.
Alisa Baker has information about the death of Zara Baker.
Alisa comes clean, if you want to call it that, and she says, well, you know what? Zara actually died. She died.
Alisa claims she found the girl unresponsive in her bed on the night of September 24th. Instead of calling the paramedics, she claims Zara's father disposed of her body in the woods.
Detective, put the evidence here.
No one is prepared for what they find. The little girl with the sunny smile is in pieces.
I remember being shocked, a sense of revulsion.
Prosecutor Jay Gaither will never forget the grisly find.
The first bone that was recovered was the lower leg. The remains of the upper torso and part of the arm.
Investigators realize little Zara's body has been dumped where animal carcasses are common.
It's up there.
So as part of a plea deal that Elisa makes with cops, she shows them where some of the body parts are. So she had motive to show them. She was going to get a reward for showing them.
It was a site that was used by hunters to dispose of dead animal carcasses.
I got it!
Clearly, the intent in disposing of Zara Baker's remains in that area was to have them dispersed by animals and have degradation and deprivation work upon the remains.
But investigators aren't convinced Zara's dismembering happened after she's dumped. They believe it happened before, by Alyssa's hand.
To imagine and think of the mindset of taking a 14, 15-inch, 3-pound miter saw and going through another person's flesh and bone. Oddly enough, what disturbs us the most in this case occurred after death. And so was not something that the victim, of course, would feel, but we all are just deeply, deeply revolted. I had dreams about it. I know I stayed up late, didn't sleep well.
It's very unusual for a killer to dismember their victim's body. It's especially unusual for a female killer to dismember the body of their child victim. I've never even heard of it until now.
Alyssa denies everything and blames Zara's dad, Adam.
She points the finger at Adam and she says, you know what? He did it. Not me. I just went along for the ride.
But Adam can prove he wasn't near the dumping ground the night of the murder. And Alyssa's cell phone records prove she was. Authorities charge Alyssa Baker with second-degree aggravated murder, and she doesn't contest it. Adam Baker isn't charged with his daughter's murder.
There's a big difference between not being a guilty party and not being a responsible party. I think that he used poor judgment in bringing her over here and putting her in the care of Alyssa Baker. Then he is responsible to some extent for what happens to her.
On September 15th, 2011, Alyssa pleads guilty and is sentenced to 15 to 18 years in prison. Zara's official cause of death is undetermined homicidal violence. A heartbreaking end to a brave little life.
Her skull was never recovered, and there was nothing in the remains that we found, as scant as those remains were, that would show that death had occurred by any particular means.
Alyssa Baker is the only one that knows what happened to that 10-year-old girl. She's the only one that knows why she committed this act of ultimate evil. Nobody else on the planet knows. And right now, she's not willing to talk.
Did Alyssa kill Zara out of spite, jealousy, or for her own amusement? Her history of abuse and manipulation makes anything possible.
What was Alyssa thinking about leading up to this murder and at the time of the killing? Nothing but herself. That's what narcissists do. And Alyssa, she could be the queen of them.
Sociopaths like to play games with the police. I'll tell you this, but I won't tell you that. Zara's skull, if ever found, will tell the story of how she truly died.
Once the honeymoon is over,
she would be very charming, very soft-spoken.
And the rose-colored glasses come off.
The whole demeanor seemed to change.
Life for some newlyweds.
Della enjoyed the emotional suffering of others.
Can be hard to survive.
What a bad, bad choice he made.
For some men, the most alluring woman is one who needs their care. When she has the looks as well, she becomes irresistible. Cincinnati Belle, Della Sutorius, has both qualities.
She had very delicate features. She's a pretty woman. And I think that she could look like she was very vulnerable.
And there's no shortage of men ready to protect her.
She would be very charming, very soft-spoken, almost childlike.
By the 1980s, Della has been married twice and is sizing up husband number three, Grant Bassett.
I got my baby.
He was just very taken with her. She had this tiny little voice.
You deserve it. You're so strong and wonderful.
She told him she'd had an abusive childhood.
Will you marry me?
Yes!
Grant, yes. Like the husbands before him, wants to protect the delicate Della from the harsh world. But Grant will soon discover it won't be Della who needs protection.
As soon as they got married, the whole demeanor seemed to change.
Dare you try and control my life? I should never have married a nerd like you.
She became critical. She became very difficult and argumentative. She told him he was stupid.
Beneath Della's delicate facade, there's a violent bully. During one attack, Grant fears for his life and calls for help.
Call police!
Grant and Della had a fight in which he ended up calling 911.
But Della isn't just violent.
I'll tell them you hurt me.
She's cunning.
Before the police got there to arrest her, she beats herself up and blames him for it.
Stop it!
The police couldn't quite sort out what was going on, so they arrested him.
Grant is cleared and soon joins the long list of Della's former husbands. They divorce.
Della's relationships started out good. She was all sweetness and kind and easy to be with, but as soon as she got that ring on her hand, things changed. The real Della came out.
Her trail of destruction stretches back even further to Della's childhood.
Mom! Mommy!
Even as a very young child, she would torment her siblings.
What's wrong, girl?
She would threaten them with physical harm if they didn't do what she asked.
Play nice.
When things would get going and everybody would be laughing and enjoying the game, Della would destroy it.
There's something about Della. As she grows, so does her mean streak.
Della's difficult childhood had every hallmark that Della was going to be a dangerous adult woman.
In 1992, husband number four, 29-year-old Englishman David Bridian, has no idea what he's getting himself into.
She was much more in love with David than perhaps she had been with other husbands. There seemed to be much more of a sexual attraction there.
But trouble starts on their wedding day when Della exposes her first dark secret.
David was quite a bit younger than Della, but he didn't know how much younger until they went to get married. He was 29 at the time, and she was 42, so he was surprised to find out how old she was.
And it goes downhill from there.
She rapidly became very jealous. She would accuse him of seeing other women.
Jealous rages, physical threats, cruel humiliation.
Come back on a date, have we?
It was a work lunch.
With every new marriage, Della turns from Jekyll to Hyde.
If you cheat on me, I will have you thrown out of this country. Do you understand?
There's nothing going on.
We shared stories not only from David Bridian, but from some of her other boyfriends and ex-husbands that she had over the years, and the common thread that ran throughout were her acts of violence.
David soon flees the marriage and becomes the fourth man to divorce Della. But she's not alone long. She goes back online to find a new husband. And in 1994, prominent surgeon Dr. Daryl Sartorius, a recent divorcee, walks blissfully into a minefield.
Oh, baby.
He was very lonely, and so one of the things that he did was he went to a dating service.
Della looks like the beautiful and vulnerable woman the 55-year-old is looking for. They fall in love and marry after just 4 months.
I'm a bride.
Della was beginning to think about long-term financial plans. She wasn't getting any younger. Her relationships had failed in the past. And it was obvious to us that she was looking to Dr. Sartorius for financial gain and financial stability.
Then, in Della's typical MO, once the nuptials are out of the way, the love evaporates. She even moves into a separate bedroom.
She immediately took possession of a bedroom on an upper level and immediately placed a lock on the door.
Next, she tries to turn her husband against his own daughter from a previous marriage. Deborah is planning a wedding, and Daddy is paying.
So Della made it very clear that she did not expect her husband to be putting much money into this wedding.
He even went so far as to tell his daughter, Deborah, not to call the house anymore because it would upset Della, and he was fearful for his own life.
After less than a year with his new wife, Dr. Sartorius realizes he's made a tragic mistake. He talks to his lawyer about ending the marriage.
Daryl reportedly said to Della, "I'll see you in court." And she responded, "I'll see you dead." No one left Della.
Strong. To the world, she's a delicate beauty, looking for comfort in the arms of a protective man. But in truth, Della Sartorius is a sociopathic bully, trapping men into marriage before destroying their lives.
I think the best thing to be learned here is never marry a woman whose last name rhymes with notorious.
I have to get this done as soon as possible.
Respected surgeon Dr. Daryl Sartorius is Della's fifth husband. And like all those before him, within months of marrying Della, he's filing for divorce.
I may not live through this. I'm serious.
He was becoming physically fearful of Della taking his life. He also told friends and family members that he had a great concern for his own safety.
Before he can file the divorce papers, Daryl goes missing on Sunday, February 18th, 1996.
One of Dr. Sartorius's patients had taken a bad turn over the weekend. And so the hospital was paging him, and he wasn't answering his page. Well, that was very unusual.
When colleagues can't raise the trusted surgeon, they alert police. Their first stop is the family home and his dutiful wife.
And she said, well, he isn't here. Well, do you know where he is?
No, I haven't seen him.
And they said, well, is his car here?
Yeah, it is.
And they said, well, ma'am, can we check?
Sure.
And she said, okay, I'll look around the house. And she said, I'll check in the basement. They followed her downstairs, and one of the detectives said that, you know, within two steps down the stairs, they could tell by the odor that there was a body in the basement.
The good doctor seems to have taken his own life, perhaps under the strain of an imminent divorce. But almost immediately, investigators notice anomalies.
In all the years of detectives' investigation of homicide and suicide scenes, he had never seen a suicide that looked like this.
They found that blood was smeared and moved, not only on the front of the couch, but on a safe across the room. That means that the scene was disturbed after he was immobilized. Another key piece of evidence of that death scene was that there was blood on the handle of the gun. When somebody holds a gun to their head, there's not sufficient blowback of blood to deposit enough blood on your palm and fingers so that it gets deposited on the handle of the gun.
And it doesn't take long to piece together the real story.
Della knew that if Dr. Sartorius would file for a divorce, the gravy train would end for her.
Della married Daryl for his money. If they divorced, she'd get almost nothing.
Until now, Della's violence is never fatal. For all her threats and humiliation, she has left her husbands with their lives. Not this time.
Della didn't want to fight with Daryl. She didn't want a confrontation. So she shot him in the head while he was sleeping.
This was a fatal, devastating wound to the back of the head, and that would have killed him instantly.
What she forgot, and perhaps what she never knew, was that it was virtually impossible to cause a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the back of the head, holding the muzzle away from the skull and creating that angle of fire.
Della's not the first woman to shoot her husband in the head while he was sleeping and then try to make it look like a suicide. The problem is, Della didn't know what crime scene experts know.
In June 1996, Della Sartorius is convicted of aggravated murder and sentenced to a total of 23 years in jail. She leaves a wake of misery and broken dreams. For the men who loved her, their only memory is betrayal. They took her in only to be abused, assaulted, even murdered. None could give her what she wanted.
I think she didn't want to be on her own. She wanted to be taken care of. She seemed to feel like she deserved to be taken care of. I don't know that Della ever would have been satisfied with anything. I don't know that anything would have ever been enough for her.
But Della can never hurt another person. In 2010, she dies in prison, aged 60, of natural causes. Las Vegas police receive a 911 call from a woman in distress.
She started whispering to please send help. She was going to get killed.
Before the operator can get details, the woman goes silent.
Within seconds of that phone going silent, you hear 5 or 6 gunshots. And then suddenly the line goes dead.
Every shot is recorded and crucial to solving the case.
The 911 call became essentially a witness for the prosecution.
Living in New York is many people's dream. But in 1997, 43-year-old Sandy Greenspan is tired of her life here.
Sandy was stuck in a moment when she was middle-aged. She had a grown daughter, and she was a very good dental hygienist, easily making over $75,000 a year.
But Sandy wants a new adventure and finds it online. A real He-Man, Frank Kane, living in Sin City, Las Vegas.
Frank Kane had a lot of dreams and a lot of great stories.
Frank presented himself as a bounty hunter, former CIA officer, person who had said he had owned 2 slaves at one point in foreign countries.
The internet very much can feed into illusions that the person that you're connecting with online is everything you want them to be. And they fall in love. They're falling in love with an illusion.
Internet chat soon becomes much more.
Sandy, hi there.
Sandy uprooted her life and basically left her prior husband and her family behind.
Are you going to invite me in?
Of course, come in.
It was a traumatic thing for her family. They eventually disowned her out of disgust over the whole situation.
Meanwhile, her new life with her bounty hunter is a blast.
Frank Kane took her out to shooting galleries. This is the new excitement that she signed up to do.
This was so very different from her prior life.
You're not true.
Of a housewife who just went to work every day and came home to a husband and kids.
She is not only living with this exciting guy who hunts fugitives from justice, she probably started getting a little bit more of a bravado that she never had before in her life.
Sandy divorces her first husband to marry her bounty hunter. She takes to his world of guns.
She became very comfortable with that handgun, and she carried that gun with her at all times.
But soon the relationship takes a strange turn. Frank insists on a contract between them, on his terms.
He had her write out and sign a contract where he was going to be the dominant individual in a relationship.
The terms of the contract were that Sandy had to do whatever Frank wanted.
Okay, good. Add that whenever we go out, you have to walk 5 paces behind me.
Whether it be sexual favors.
Really?
You're gonna be my slave, don't you?
Obeying his every command.
Okay, it's done.
Now, we both sign it.
To be completely subservient to him.
he was a brute, psychologically and sometimes physically. Sandy and Frank did have a master-slave relationship.
Sandy's put her life, future, and money in Frank's hands. Far from being the energetic bounty hunter, Frank is proving to be more of a slacker.
Hello?
Happy to live off Sandy's salary.
He had repeatedly lied to her about their future together and starting a business.
But it soon backfires.
That was the bank. You maxed out both my credit cards.
I needed cash for my new venture.
What new venture?
I'm making sex furniture.
And all what Frank Kane would do is lay on the couch watching TV, true to his form, never had any follow through with any of his plans or his ideas.
She leaves her family for the excitement of Las Vegas. But the reality is, she's rarely allowed to leave her living room.
Hey!
Let's go out.
What for?
For fun. Come on, we never go out.
They stayed in their apartment. They had no friends, no contacts with anybody on the outside.
Here she was, obeying his every order.
You're not going anywhere.
Working long hours to pay all the bills. He's racking up debt in her name. She just came to conclude that he was a loser and really came to hate him for it. And she came to a point where she knew she had to do something.
Las Vegas attracts people for excitement and adventure. When 47-year-old Sandy comes here after meeting a new man online, that's not what she gets. Frank is so controlling and stifling, she can see only one way out.
She was married to a weird guy who wanted her to be his slave.
Sandy's decision to leave her first family is haunting her.
Family back in New York is not talking to her anymore.
Sandy, even if she was unhappy in her prior life, you know, she threw it all away for this guy who turned out to be a loser and a con artist.
Isolated, humiliated, and broke. Sandy wants someone to pay. October 2001. Frank starts his day the usual way. Sandy's plan involves a 911 call, not after a family tragedy, but before.
Help. He is going to kill me.
It gives a preemptive alibi, and she leaves the phone off the hook to record what she pretends to be a brutal attack. But there's no assault, just cold-hearted murder.
Frank Kane was sleeping. I don't think she'd made any efforts to wake him up. She pulled out the gun, walked up within 2 to 3 feet from his torso, and fired point blank right into his chest.
Why did she have to be so close to him? She wanted to. She wanted to make sure those bullets went to exactly where she was pointing.
All 911 calls are recorded. Frank's final moments are captured until Sandy hangs up.
I think Sandy called 911 so that they would be a witness, but she didn't think it through.
911 operators are trained to call back immediately. But there's just one problem with Sandy's scenario. On the recording, there is no sound of a fight, so her self-defense claims are ringing hollow.
Sandy actually claimed that she put the phone down when she was talking to 911 to go back to where Frank was and see if he was really still threatening her. Not only does that make no sense, it's comical.
The call that Sandy wants to be her alibi now incriminates her, and so do the forensics.
The blood pattern analysis indicated to authorities that Frank was lying on his back at the time he was shot.
There were no defensive wounds indicating that Frank Kane held up his hands trying to protect himself.
Prosecutors have all they need, but there's no trial. Sandy enters a no-contest plea to second-degree murder. In May 2002, she is sentenced to 10 to 25 years in prison.
Sandy shot Frank because she was sick of the guy. I mean, he had caused so much misery in her life and caused so much disappointment, and she couldn't take it anymore.
Few dispute Sandy suffers at the hands of Frank, the man she met online. But few can understand why she resorted to murder.
This woman could have easily divorced Frank Kane, filed for bankruptcy, and with her talents and education skills, she could have easily fallen right back to her feet. But she chose to commit murder, and she premeditated, she deliberated, she thought about it, she schemed it.
There is a degree of accountability here for Sandy that she chose to go live with Frank. She chose to go leave her former life behind. You know, she trusted someone without really checking out who he was.
Ultimately, it ended up being a true mistake.
Sandy Kane is released on parole in 2011.
Sandy probably could have left Frank, but it wouldn't have given her the satisfaction of killing him. She was angry.
These deadly women used the search for love to find their victims. Alyssa Baker took delight in torturing a vulnerable little girl. Della Sartorius found murder more agreeable than divorce. And Sandy Kane could only find happiness in a loaded gun. These three women share a common thread. They trapped their victims in a tangled web of death.